Steve Hendrickson will be given a lecture today on Tlingit war armor, war helmets in particular. The reasons are, as I said, twofold. One, you're going to see it in person today, but it's going to be recorded, and it'll be shown on television throughout the state in a series of recordings. But the second reason, and I think it's very important, is that one of the problems that I've seen in my life is the lack of historical documentation for the Native people in Alaska in our history books. In our history books, you could go to the state history books that are used in the classrooms around the state, and you'll not see anything on these war helmets. You'll not see anything about Anska. You'll not see anything about Roy or Elizabeth Paradovich. You'll not see anything about Anska. The history that we're trying to preserve is a history of our own, of ourselves, of our people. Because nobody's going to tell our history unless we tell it ourselves. And we're really grateful to an individual like Mr. Hendrickson here, who is very knowledgeable about something we don't even know much about. It's people like himself who are going to help us keep the language, keep the history alive about these particular pieces of history that belong to us. Now, many of you know that Steve Hendrickson is a curator of collections at the Alaska State Museum, and he's an adjunct instructor at the University of Alaska Southeast in Juneau. He specializes in Tlingit material culture and art, Tlingit art, culture, history, and war helmets in particular. Mr. Hendrickson's expertise has helped in the preservation and protection of some of Southeast Alaska's most valuable atu. His knowledge of Tlingit armor and helmets have helped identify Tlingit objects so they could return to Southeast Alaska from other parts of the world, and especially in lower 48 of America. Mr. Hendrickson's knowledge has aided in the continuation of education of Tlingit history and culture. He has lived in Juneau, Alaska for many years and has been actively organizing the periodic Tlingit clan conferences that are so prevalent now in Southeast Alaska. His lecture will feature images of armor mostly housed in museums and cultural centers around the world. Mr. Hendrickson has located nearly 100 war helmets in museums and private collections, with new ones showing up every year or two. The helmets, elaborately carved with fearsome sculptures of clan crest ancestors and spirits, are part of a system of armor that protected the face, body, and appendages of Tlingit warriors. The armor was designed to protect warriors from traditional weapons, arrows, daggers, spears, and clubs, many of which were elaborately decorated. By the 19th century, these helmets and protective gear became commonplace became obsolete when high-powered firearms became commonplace because they could penetrate very easily the armor of that were used. So without further ado, I really want to tell you how much I appreciate personally Mr. Hendrickson and his contribution to the Native community and the work that he's done. Would you please welcome Mr. Steve Hendrickson?
Well, thank you very much, Senator Kukesh, and thank you to Rosita and the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute for having me. And let me get back to the beginning here. I have been researching this subject for almost 30 years now, and I got my start when I was an undergraduate at Portland State University taking a general art history 101 class. And I studied art from around the world in that class, but I was really fascinated by the art of the Northwest Coast Native people. And our assignment was to write a term paper about one of the many works of art in our textbook. And the only example of of Native American art in the textbook was a photograph of a war helmet. And that's where I got my start, and I began looking in books at that time. This was pre-internet. So I checked out all the books I could about Northwest Coast art and located about 60 or so war helmets and pieces of armor in distant museum collections. And then over the years, I just kept that up. And of course, now a lot of this is available on the internet at various museum and cultural center websites where you can go up and look at images of things in their collections. But amazingly enough, new armor comes up almost every year now because it had been miscataloged or otherwise not available in a private collection. But every once in a while, something new will come up, and at the end I have a few new ones to show you. Since the last time I gave this presentation, even there's still new ones coming up, so it makes it hard for me to know when I should stop researching and start writing it up, because you know it's like, well, I'll do this and something else will come up and it'll rewrite everything. But actually I think chances are there's not a whole lot more, although because of the nature of the collecting of artifacts on the Northwest Coast, the material has really spread out all over the world, with the concentrations being the East Coast of North America and in Europe, some of the Russian collections and other European countries in their national museums. They've ended up with large collections of Alaska Native artifacts. So even though there's a great deal of artistry associated with the armor, I'd like to emphasize that it's not just art. It's something that was designed to be functional, and it's also a story of technology and how over a course of many, many years the armor technology was refined to the point where it was perfectly suited for the traditional types of combat that was engaged in. And then even towards the end, when firearms did make their appearance on the Northwest Coast and were purchased through traders and used in combat, even then they made efforts to reinforce that armor using the same kind of approach that modern armor makers take, and that's using layers of different kinds of materials. By layering those materials up, it has a greater chance of slowing a lead bullet or buckshot down enough to not to be able to penetrate. And I have some examples of that to show you. But let's go ahead and get started with some of the images. And I just wanted to say, looking around the room here, it's as if this room was designed to have this presentation or presentations on warriors, because there's so much art in this room that relates to it. The Bill Holm Raven Warrior print, there's a Sea Alaska poster from early in the Native Corporation days, and of course the Preston Singletary house post behind me. And is it Mick or Rick's war helmet here? One of a pair that he did maybe 15 years ago or so. So it's really a beautiful space to be showing you these images in. Now, I did want to thank several people that have helped me over the years in really understanding the importance of armor and how it was used. George Bennett Sr., George Ramos, and Mark Jacobs Sr., all of these men carry parts of the story with them and have been really willing to pass it on and keep it alive. So I really have to thank them a great deal for what you're about to see. The early European explorers, or mostly traders, but there were some government expeditions sent up here as well, they describe Tlingit warriors using armor, in some cases against them. And they were very concerned about that as a matter of strategy. They tried to collect examples of the armor so they could assess the threat that it represented to them. And also they wanted to make a show of force to the natives that they came into contact with. And sometimes they would ask to borrow a piece of armor, and they would fold it in half and lean it up against a stump and have their soldiers fire a bullet through it and then show the hole to everybody. So from the get-go, the message was sent, you know, don't mess with us. Your armor is really useless. But as we'll see, the effort was made to not capitulate, but to reinforce that armor. And, I have mixed emotions about focusing on armor so much because I'm concerned that people will get the impression that the Tlingits are warlike. And that's something that goes all the way back to the European descriptions of Tlingit warriors and other tribes along the coast who were doing nothing more than standing up for their rights. And the Europeans felt that was warlike, and so they added that to their descriptions. And you know, I'm going to be talking a lot about armor, but we all know that Tlingit culture is based on love and respect, and very much war was something that everybody wanted to avoid, worked hard to avoid it, and if it did happen, efforts were made to end it very quickly. And I think that armor was not only an effective way to protect individuals from harm, but it also was a check in the cycle of violence that might happen during a war or an extended feud between clans, in that in doing battle, you're not creating more casualties that would require an escalation of violence. I think it kept the violence in check, so it was all the more easier to forge peace afterwards. So I think in that way, it really had a use beyond protecting the individual. It protected the clans from decimating each other. So the best early drawing of a warrior in armor came from the Spanish artist Soria, Tomas de Soria, in 1792 at the Yakutat area. And his fantastic drawing of a warrior wearing armor with the helmet, a face protector, and wooden slat armor and thick leather armor underneath it. And it very much coincides with armor collected around the same time. On the right is a set of armor in the Peter the Great Museum of Anthropology in St. Petersburg, showing pretty much what you see in the drawing. So the warrior, incidentally, is holding the bow horizontally, and that's the way they used it, was horizontally rather than the Western style. Much of the wars that took place between clans and native nations were not fought with armor, even though we have close to 95 examples of war helmets. I think most warriors probably did not do battle with armor. The types of battles that they had were often required a lot of quick movements, and if you're wearing that armor, it's fairly heavy and bulky, and it restricts your movement. So it would only be employed in very strategic ways. Typically, a warrior would just have, a dagger, other weapons, would tie his hair up in a top knot, paint his face black, and maybe have some hide armor on, if anything. So many wars were just fought with daggers, like the one you see on the right that the Tekwedi clan in Angoon has. There's all kinds of other weapons, bows and arrows, spears, and a variety of clubs, including this one, which is a pretty unique one at the American Museum of Natural History. It's a caribou antler, and the tines of the antler have been sharpened. They're almost like chisel points, and then the handles on the right, and so you could, with a slashing motion, you could cause a lot of damage by the series of sharpened edges coming into contact. And then, of course, the war club or war pick with in this case, a jade blade fixed in a wooden handle. And this is probably one of the weapons that motivated the development of the war helmet, because of the damage that could inflict on someone. And later on, firearms, of course, first the flintlock variety, and then later the percussion cap type. This is a blunderbuss. There were a few of those traded, but mostly we're dealing with something like a 65 to 75 caliber smoothbore musket. And in addition to having the musket, you had to have a whole set of accessories to operate it, a pouch to keep it all in, a powder horn for the gunpowder. There's a thing for percussion caps, that leather disc. There's bullet molds, there's powder measures, and a little powder bag down there. So there's a lot of equipment necessary to operate this. And if you had to pick an environment on Earth that was the least conducive to using this kind of weapon, it would be the Northwest Coast, because just the condensation on the metal parts would be enough to foul the gunpowder and cause you to have a misfire. And also, these are smoothbore muskets, at least the earliest ones introduced, so the accuracy wasn't exactly terrific, although it is quite possible for you to have a lot of accuracy if you have the time to load it properly. But in a battle context, fighting in a style other than what the Europeans did, which were you line up, you follow commands to load, and everybody's doing the same thing, and you can consistently press the bullet on top of the powder with the right amount of pressure. You can have a patch around the ball so the bullet doesn't roll back and forth in the barrel. All of those steps add to the accuracy, but in a Northwest Coast context, it wouldn't have been like that, and so you wouldn't be able to get the accuracy out of a weapon like this. So there was one account that early European had that he witnessed a battle between clans, and he said in battle the sides would watch for a puff of gunpowder, and then they would dive to one side or another because there was enough of a lag time there for them to get out of the way of the bullet. But the accuracy here was so poor that you were probably better off just standing stationary because you might dive into the path of the bullet. So there's some of the early Spanish expeditions collected some armor. And again, this might have been to take back to their own weapons laboratories to study. And this is from 1792. It's in Madrid now. It's a bear helmet from the Yakutat area. And this is probably the most common type of war helmet, is one with a humanoid face on it rather than a recognizable crest animal or supernatural creature. It's more of a fairly realistic humanoid face, and that could be an ancestor or a spirit. It's very much, it looks like it could be a mask that's somehow mounted on a dome of wood, but they're all always carved out of one piece. And they're carved fairly thick, out of thick wood. I mean, it's a solid piece of wood, and they leave it very thick. The backs are usually just rounded like this and have a formline design, and it's one of the few types of formline design that they did it on a white background pretty consistently. They painted it white first and then put a red primary formlines over the top of that, and you really don't see that much in other types of formline decorated objects. So this is a hat that more along the lines of what would be used for ceremonial purposes. It's a representing a primary crest of a clan, and the function of these is not for protection. It's for representing the clan, for identification of the clan members, and for ritual use at kuiks and memorial potlatches. And the carver here would try to carve the wood fairly thin to prevent checking. They carve the wood green, and that's an issue when you're carving, to make sure it's well hollowed out. And any area that's left thick is going to be prone to splitting, especially on the thin brim. So they tried to make it as thin as possible, and if any checks did open up during the drying process, a lot of times they close back up after the wood is completely dry. But war helmets are different. They are typically carved from a piece of wood that has twisted grain, something like a burl from a tree, something that's got the grain going all different directions, so it's less prone to splitting. And not only in the drying process, but if you hit someone on the head with a war pick, for instance, that a normal piece of wood, that would just open it right up. But with a burled piece of wood with the grain going all over, it has a tendency more to stick together. Plus, a lot of these have a heavy layer of rawhide that's formed over the top of them and nailed down or pegged down around the perimeter. So it's it'd be very hard to split that. These are range from an inch to an inch and a half in thickness, so it's much thicker than the typical crest hat would be. And inside, they would have a layer of padding, something perhaps like this fur cap. In other cases, they actually glued the skins of birds, the body skin, so it has a layer of down on the inside to cushion the inside. So I'll show a couple more examples of the humanoid type of war helmet. There's several that have very fierce expressions, and one of the functions, I think, of war helmets and armor in general is to provide an element of psychological warfare. In Alexander Bronov, in 1790s, was in the middle of the night, was set upon by a group of Tlingit warriors, and he has a very vivid description of how terrified this made everybody see, because these big figures just materialized in the middle of their camp. Because of the layers of padding, they were all really big and tall. The helmet might add another 6 inches to 8 inches on top, so it just made people think these were big guys. And he also said that the armor was impervious to bullets. It's a really interesting account. But some of the helmets actually have fierce expressions on their carved on the faces to add to that element of psychological warfare. The one on the left actually is the one from Dry Bay that was in my art history textbook that I started writing about this. The one on the right is a beautiful helmet from the Taku River. It's at the Smithsonian. And I think it's on display at the Arctic Studies Center in Anchorage now. But that comes from this area. The one on the right, again, is a fairly typical humanoid helmet. This one has opercula shells in the mouth representing teeth and human hair that's pegged over the lip and under the chin to represent facial hair. On the right is the only helmet that depicts a female. And this one is on display at the Louvre in Paris. And we know that because of the labret that she has in her lip. Unfortunately, there's no documentation with this that would say where it's from or what the image represents. But it's typically, especially nowadays, the opinion seems to be that women really didn't have any role in warfare, that they were not even allowed to handle the armor or weapons, and they basically would have no association with it. But there are a few historical accounts of women participating in battle, and also this, if this is a spirit, it could represent a female spirit. So it's hard to say exactly the meaning here, but it is, like I say, out of 90 some helmets, this is the only one representing a woman. There's some humanoid helmets that have, you know, maybe four or five of them have a human face and then this kind of a crest over the top, a ridge running from the top of one ear over to the top of the other. And then that ridge has formaline design on it. These are both really early, from the late 1700s, early 1800s. But probably more common as a group are helmets that represent animals of various sorts. And a few of these we have in the collection records that the museums maintain, what the collector said the people he obtained it from said it represented. And this one was collected by George Emmons in Wrangell, I believe, in the late 1800s, and he said this represented a cheek, which is murrelet. And from the shape of the body, I think that could very well be accurate. And this is, there's only two helmets that I have come across so far that are documented as coming from the Haida, even though in Haida tradition they talk about having armor as well as the Tsimshian. But this and a companion to it, also an eagle, are the only ones that are known to be Haida from Old Kassan. So I'm not sure how to explain the difference there. It could just be an error in the documentation that the museums have, but certainly there's plenty of evidence that both the Haida and Tsimshian also used war helmets and armor. Some helmets use the head skin of a bear, a brown bear, stretched over a plain wooden form to be a war helmet. This is the most elaborate one of those, and it's at the Peabody Museum at Harvard. It has little bear faces that are mounted over the ears of the bear. And this is missing most of its fur, and it's faded quite a bit, so it looks like kind of like a polar bear now, but it actually is a brown bear. There's some helmets that, these are all just educated guesses for the most part. This is not information that's been handed down in clans or in the collector's notes from the time this was collected. These are just educated guesses based on the appearance and sometimes the area, general area where it comes from. This one has no documentation, and to try to make sense out of what it is, a lot of people have suggested that it's a rodent of some kind, maybe a mouse or some other member of the order Rodentia. But, you know, it's still just a guess. It does have the real bulgy eyes that you might associate with a rodent of some sort. But whatever it is, and this is the case across the board, they go to great effort to make it a fierce example of a bird or a mammal or something else. They really put expression into it or exaggerate the features in a rather fearsome way to add again to that psychological effect. And Alexander Baranov, in his written description of the battle he went through, the first battle he went through, he said they wore terrifying visages on their heads. So he was really struck by the fearsomeness of the sculpture. So there's seven or eight helmets representing whales, a couple representing killer whales with a added piece of wood for the dorsal fin. And this one has a seal in its mouth, and that may point to it being from the killer whale chasing seal house of Angoon. Here's a couple more whale helmets, one at the British Museum on the left. The other one's in the Peabody Museum. The one on the left, probably a whale. The one on the right, it's a little less clear that it's a whale. There's no recognizable eyes there or a mouth. Whales usually have broad mouths, sometimes with teeth in them. It's unclear exactly what that could be. Sea lions are there. They're rather fierce creatures in nature, and so it doesn't take too much exaggeration to make them look fierce in helmet form. This one has actual sea lion whiskers attached to the nose, and possibly sea lion teeth inlaid in the mouth as well. Fairly realistic in its depiction, and very much like the way you see their heads when they're swimming through the water, they have their noses up in the air and making all that racket. And there's some helmets really defy, they're really unique and they defy easy interpretation. And this one, it's very carved very much like a typical humanoid helmet, but it has it's sprouting sea lion whiskers out of the mouth, and it could be one of those examples in Northwest Coast Art that you see of a human transforming into an animal or back again. And transformation, according to the old stories, was something that happened a lot, and on the spur of the moment, a person could change form, like almost like putting on a set of clothing, just taking on and off a new identity. And this could be an example of that, the face of a human that frozen in the process of transformation. There's probably five or six helmets representing sharks or dogfish that have the kind of this, it's at an upward angle, has a ridge on it that has a form line design representing a hawk according to the documentation. On one side, a large open mouth with nostrils that are kind of like a, they're not really nostrils, but they're on the head of a shark. There's these water intakes for the gills in front there. And then on the back, a representation of maybe the tail of the shark or the head, where it's not really clear. And this is another possible transformation helmet that has on the left, the image on the left, you can see the human face, but it has this tall forehead, and then right behind the ear it switches over to a formline design, and this is a picture of the back of it. And if you look, notice right behind the ear, you can see these crescent shapes that are gills, and so it could be a humanoid shark, or at least, you know, or showing a the act of transformation. So, you know, in trying to come up with different explanations for different kinds of helmets, I've looked pretty broadly around Tlingit culture for possible connections. And one of the connections that we see is between warfare and shamanism. And the shamans, they were warriors also. Their job, one of their primary jobs was to do battle with evil spirits or the spirits that were aiding enemies in real life, in the life of people. They had wands and charms that represented, were like non-functional replicas of actual weapons used by warriors in physical combat. On the left, there is a shaman's war pick. It doesn't have a stone blade. It has a flimsy wooden blade in it, and they didn't actually hit anybody with it, but in the practice of combating evil spirits, they would use their own version of a war pick and also daggers. In this posed photo of a shaman, he's got a replica of a dagger that he's fighting spirits that are infecting his patient there below. So he's doing battle with spirits just like warriors do battle in the physical realm. The most typical kind of humanoid war helmet is very similar to the kinds of hats that shamans used when they were doing battle with spirits. The picture on the left is a shaman's headdress. On the right is a war helmet. And the way that the face sits right on top of the forehead, kind of slanted back, it leads to the possibility that maybe warriors are wearing replicas of shaman's gear, or shamans are wearing replicas of warriors' gear. Also, some helmets have small little figurines kind of coming out of the sides of the face, which is something that you see typically on shamans' equipment, including masks. Like the one on the right has otters that are coming out of the cheeks and over the forehead. And sometimes on shaman's equipment, those are spirit helpers of the shaman. The shaman has a set of spirit helpers that assist them in doing combat and some of the other things they engage in that are depicted on their artifacts that they use. And possibly warriors are doing the same thing. This is a special kind of war shaman's headdress that is called in the literature a war hat, a war bonnet. And shamans are said to use this kind of headgear when they actually accompany warriors into battle. When they're in their canoes going to the battle, they go into a trance and they fly ahead of the war party to spy on the enemy, to see where they're holed up at. And they also, in the process, they encounter the shaman of the other side, and they actually have combat in the spirit world as well. And for that, they use this type of headdress. There's about five war helmets that are replicas of that kind of shaman's hat. They're flexible. The shaman's versions are, and you put them on the head, and they have they're kind of flat from each side, kind of like the old style Boy Scout hats that you can tuck in your belt, or you open them up and put them on. These, though, are solid wood, so they're not flexible, and they're thick enough, again, to prevent damage in warfare. So another, you know, another connection, albeit somewhat tenuous, between armor and shaman's equipment is that apparently sometimes the helmets and armor were disposed of in graves or by leaving them out in the elements and letting them deteriorate naturally. On the right is a war helmet that's in the Sheldon Jackson Museum collection that was found somewhere, and it had been in the process deteriorated substantially by the elements. On the left is Steve Brown's interpretation of what that once looked like based on what's left of it and traces of paint that are still on it. That's another sea lion helmet. And there's this amazing set of three helmets that was found by hunters on Prince of Wales Island, or one of the islands in the vicinity. It was just found out in the middle of the woods in the remains of a bentwood box. There was no human remains present. It was just left out there. And these, I believe, were from the Tongass National Forest, and so the Forest Service has been in the process of repatriating these. But this one actually is a humanoid helmet, very early looking sculpture, and it must have been laying upside down because more than half of it is just not there anymore. And then this other one, this is Bill Holmes' interpretation of what it once looked like there on the lower left. It's been interpreted as a merganser from the shape of the head, the teeth that are in the beak, which is, you know, you normally don't think of birds having teeth, but mergansers have serrations in their beak that help them catch fish, and they also have a little crest of feathers on the back of the head. So that could be what's going on here. Turning again to the rest of the armor system, the helmets were part of this whole system that covered most of the vital areas of the body. And it consisted of a wooden face protector that was held right underneath the helmet, and then body armor, either wooden slat armor twined together with nettle fibers or sinew, and also leather or rawhide using the thickest leather available, moose or in some cases sea lion, and elk hides from the Columbia River were for some reason very highly sought after on the northern northwest coast. So the face protector, it slides up right underneath the helmet, and the intersection between them is right at eye level, so there's little divots in the top of the face protector so you could see out of. And the way this is held up is that the warrior slides it up into place and bites on, there's the eye openings, and on the inside there's a little bite block that you hold that up against your face by biting on that loop of spruce root. And it's so close that they had to drill a breathing hole. You can see that right in the front of these visors, so that the warrior could breathe out of. You can see those little depressions there for the eye right along the top. Let's see. Mostly in museum collections, the visors or the face protectors were not collected usually with the helmets. They were separated. But there are a few exceptions to that. This one's at the William Seward House in Auburn, New York. When after Seward left office as Secretary of State, he came up to Alaska a year or two later just to take a look at it. He had never been here. And during that visit, he collected a small group of mostly Tlingit and some Haida artifacts, and had this helmet and a face protector were collected together. And both the helmet and the face protector show signs of deterioration, so that, you know, could have been in a grave or otherwise was exposed to the elements. And, in talking to people about, you know, why would you just if it wasn't part of a grave, why would you just leave something out in the middle of the woods to let it deteriorate? And one of the people said, it's too powerful to keep, but too powerful to destroy. And so you leave it alone and back away from it and just let it go back to its elements. So this is another helmet that has a face protector that's associated with it, a frog. And this one, both of those are deteriorated, as you could see. So this could have been from a shaman's grave, where it was pretty typical for you to place shaman's equipment with the shaman in a grave house, or some other circumstance where it was left out to the elements. Here's another one. These are bent wood construction, so they're kerfed on the inside like the corners of a bent wood box, but the kerfs are spaced about every inch, and then you steam that and bend a flat board into a circle that matches the diameter of the helmet. Then the body armor, the slat armor, is made out of hardwood that's twined just like a basket together, as if the slats of wood were the warps and the sinew was the wefts, twining them together. And it's possible that weavers, female weavers, might have been in charge of putting these together. And on the sides, there's even design work that's done on the sides where the slats turn into rods where it goes around the sides of the body. You can see there's different textures there, and that's in bands on the sides. So that's the same thing as skip stitch in a basket. And they even made similar twined armor for the legs and upper arms as well. So they had the capability of covering someone from head to foot with this traditional armor, although that would severely limit your mobility. And so that warriors wearing all of this probably had to have people helping them to watch their back and to help guide them around, even in some cases. So the leather armor is fairly common. The State Museum has a couple of plain pieces of it, and mostly it wasn't decorated like the ones you see here, which are beautiful examples of formaline painting. This one is a killer whale, and the head of the whale extends around the side of the body. And this is a really interesting one. I mentioned that Columbia River elk skins were highly sought after, and some of the early Europeans got wind of that, and they made trips from the Columbia River buying up all the elk hides that they could and sending them to the Tlingit. And this one, interestingly enough, it has sides on it that are beautifully painted formline, but on the inside it's something completely different. And I think this is a Columbia River painting and it was probably made up as armor, and when it got up to Alaska, they liked the hide, but they didn't like the painting, and they turned it inside out and did formaline painting on the other side. So this has been folded to the inside for a couple hundred years, and it's in beautiful shape. And actually, there's really not much that survived from the Columbia River as far as this kind of painting. So it's a very, very precious object from that standpoint, as well as it being involved in this trade to the Tlingits. There is a watercolor from the early 1800s by Mikhail Tikhonov showing a warrior at Sitka wearing a piece of hide armor that has a painted design on it that is definitely not Tlingit. And I think this design, with the alternating background colors and the way the mouth is very, very much a Columbia River type design. And Tikhonov was so accurate with his art that he would not have just made up something and put it on there. His images of Aleut and Chugach or Aleutic and Tlingit people are just dead on in every respect. And so it's very, very probable that is a Columbia River design. This is another fragment of armor from the Columbia River that was collected from the Tsimshian. There's some of the earliest armor is It looks like a shirt, but it's a lot thicker than a typical caribou hide shirt would be. Sometimes these are collected from the Dena'ina, Athabascan, sometimes Tlingit, but many of them have strips of quill work across the front. And this is not porcupine quill work, but bird quill work using the center part of a feather. Then the veins are stripped off, and then they split the feather and dye it different colors. And then they make these long strips and apply them to the front of the armor shirt. So looking at some of the armor details, there was this one long set of armor at the American Museum of Natural History that had a sleeve. Usually the armor is sewn shut on one side, and it's just open on one side, so you have to take it over your head and put it down and then tie some toggles on the other side. And so the idea was that you presented the closed face of the armor to the enemy, and you had your dagger lashed into your hand on that side as well. And on that side of this piece of armor, there's a sleeve that's pretty rare. It has a separate little oval of wood hide that's sewn on there to protect the thumb. So you could have your dagger in here, and your whole hand, back of the hand and thumb would be protected. And the only place I've seen that before is on samurai armor from Japan. And their armor sleeves have that same kind of back of the hand and thumb protector. So in Northwest Coast collections, you sometimes see this rectangular armor made up of rods twined together. And usually the documentation is pretty vague as far as exactly what this is. It says, you know, it was meant to wrap around the trunk of the body to protect the vital organs. But the trouble is that it's not long enough to go totally around your body. There's no opening for the arm. And if you wear it underneath the arms, it's long enough, it goes down to your knees, and you wouldn't be able to walk. So that doesn't really make a lot of sense. But some of it has some arm loops on it that suggest it was put over the shoulders and worn kind of like a backpack. And, you know, you have to wonder, well, what good would that really do? But you can find these figures of shaman wearing something like that on their backs, either up to protect the back of their heads or in a down position. And the descriptions of these say that the shaman is doing battle with spirits. And so this could be a clue as to how that kind of armor was used. And another clue that we have is by looking to Siberia, to the Chukchi and other Siberian native groups that had back armor as part of their style of armor. And this was sometimes made out of rigid pieces of wood covered with leather. Sometimes it was pieced together, but these were used in arrow combat, fighting with bows and arrows. And the warriors would be able to, when they saw arrows coming in, you could turn your back and they would bounce off your armor, and then you could wheel around quickly and fire your arrows back. And there's quite a few examples of that kind of armor in different museum collections. And sometimes they have kind of a pointed top rather than being rectangular. And there's this piece of armor on the lower left is in the National Museum of the American Indian, and it's a very perfect replica of one of those Chukchi back plates with a peaked top, but this one has ovoids on it, so it's probably from the Northwest Coast. And just another type of back armor from the Arctic is made up of slabs of walrus tusks that are connected together, sometimes bone. And this one has a protector that goes around the back of the head that's made out of full slabs of a walrus tusk that are tied together. You can see the curvature of them. So I think this would have been even heavier than Tlingit wooden armor, having full slabs of walrus ivory. So I mentioned the effort to reinforce the armor. And some of the body armor shows some of those efforts by adding a layer of Chinese coins to the outer surface. The Chinese coins, these were trade items that some of the sea otter fur traders brought from China. They were able to buy these barrels of old coins from past dynasties. These are have been dated to the 1200s and 1400s, so they're well before the sea otter fur trade got going out here. They were just stockpiled in warehouses in China. They were able to get a good deal on them. They brought them out here, and Northwest Coast natives use them for decorating their regalia, but also there's efforts made to add another layer to maybe make the armor more impermeable to bullets and buckshot. And here's a piece of leather armor that has a layer of wooden slats added to the inside. And there is some effort to wear the armor in layers so you get that extra protection from the different types of materials. And that will slow down a bullet better than just a single layer of the same kind of material. Another, but you know, sooner or later, by the mid-1800s, it is clear that new armor was no longer being made. And so I think the introduction of firearms had something to do with that, possibly missionary influence or interference from the Russians and later the Americans who really wanted to try to stifle outbreaks of violence among Alaska Natives. And, you know, but the armor was very important as sacred objects to the Tlingit, so they weren't, even though they may not be using it in combat anymore, it was still, certain pieces of it were used the same way that a crest hat or a Chilkat robe might be used in a ritual context. It was used as atu, a sacred object owned by the entire group. This helmet is from Wrangell, and it's been repainted, and these giant pectoral fins were actually sewn onto it using a piece of leather. You can see the stitches there, just to make it a more flamboyant crest object. And here's an old helmet representing the sun dog that shows up in several photographs from the late 1800s. This is a posed photo of a man wearing that helmet and wearing a armor-like shirt and holding a blunderbuss. And the same helmet is over at the left, the next to the man holding a mask. There's a man wearing that same helmet from Klukwan. And he's with some people from the Gunnik Tedi, although that's probably not where the helmet originated. And then this helmet is also from a photo taken of guests arriving at a potlatch in Klukwan in the 1890s. And this man is wearing the helmet, no other piece of armor, just the helmet, and holding a rifle as the guests are coming in. And, you know, that helmet ended up in the Field Museum in Chicago. And, you know, potlatches or kuiks, even though they bring together clans that might have been at best rivals and at worst the combatants in a feud or war at some point in the past, they're peaceful events, of course, but at the beginning there's a bit of ritual where the guests approach the host's village and the hosts run out and say, "Halt, who goes there?" And the guests say, "Oh, we're here for the potlatch that you invited us to, remember?" And then the hosts say, "Oh, yes, that's right. That is today, isn't it? Well, come on ashore." And they invite them to come ashore. And in the beginning there's sometimes inferences to battle, and sometimes they might hold rifles or have a bit of armor on. One of the more famous war helmets in existence is the one that was used by the Kiksuti warrior Catlian at the Battle of Sitka in 1804. And this helmet is in the Sheldon Jackson Museum today. And there's photos of it also being used as a crest object. And that helmet comes out periodically for Kiksuti rituals. This is the bicentennial of the Battle of Sitka in 2004. The clan hosted a totem pole raising and a large event in Sitka, and the war helmet there is in the plexiglass cube. It has a hide covering, and the fur and the hide itself is actively coming off. So the clan, as well as the museum, felt that it'd be better if that was not handled or worn. And really, the clans don't typically wear these helmets in ceremonies. They hold them, or they might hold them over someone's head to give them strength, but they're typically not worn. And in the same philosophy, I guess, that you don't pull a sword out of the scabbard unless you're ready to use it. You don't put the armor on unless you're ready to drop everything and go to battle. Here is the totem pole that they put up there in the park in Sitka. It actually has a representation of the raven helmet there at the bottom. There's a lot of information on this in the Downhauer's book with Lydia Black on the battles of 1802 and 1804. Another old, well-documented helmet is this eagle helmet from Angoon, and Sam Newman was the last caretaker of it, as far as I know. There are a few contemporary helmets that show up in ceremonies today. This is one that is frequently brought out. I think Joe Zuboff carved this one, and it's brought out when they have they typically have a portion of the ceremony honoring veterans. And in this case, George Bennett and I can't think of his name is holding the helmet over Pete Karras, a veteran who, you know, to give him strength as he battles illness. So some of the, like I said, a lot of the armor has ended up in distant museum collections, and there's a lot of interest today in trying to learn more about it and possibly get some of it back. This is Ray Wilson, the Kicksetti, head of the Kicksetti, looking at armor that was very well, might have been collected by Alexander Baranov at the battle that he did with the Kicksetti. That's now in the Peter the Great Museum. And I've had the great privilege of traveling around with elders looking at museum collections, and here's Mark Jacobs holding a killer whale helmet, and Cyril George holding the eagle helmet from Angoon, and it's been quite an experience hearing what they have to say about these. And a few contemporary artists have done modern representations of armor. Tommy Joseph is probably the most prolific of those, and he had an exhibit a few years ago at the State Museum, and his material has been all over the world at this point. And this is a piece of a set of armor that we were able to purchase from him with the support of the Rasmussen Foundation, and that's on exhibit in our museum now. And this is the only helmet that he's ever carved out of yew wood, and he said he would never do it again, probably because of how hard that wood is. And a few other artists, Preston Singletary did a representation of a shark helmet there on the left out of glass. I can't think of his, Matthew Helgeson did the killer whale helmet. Stan Bevan did the helmet and visor set on the left, and this is another one by Mick Beasley with a face protector. And artists have used the images of armor and war helmets specifically for contemporary art. Tanis Selton did this installation that featured images of that dry bay war helmet that I saw in my textbook, and she did some drums that has that imagery on it representing Tlingit resistance to colonization. And as I mentioned earlier, it seems like every year or two now, new helmets are coming out of the woodwork, either at auctions or museums are discovering it in their own collections. This one is from a museum in Berlin, an old helmet that I haven't seen pictures of the other side, but it may have a slot in it for a dorsal fin. It does look kind of whale-like. This is one that showed up unexpectedly at an auction in the New England, and sold for over $1 million. This was about 6 years ago. No documentation. This one appeared at an auction, a little auction house in France, about 15 years ago. And I got a fax from somebody that happened to be traveling back there and saw this in an auction catalog and said, hey, you guys should try to purchase it. And I thought it was obscure enough that the wealthy collectors wouldn't know about it. And so I contacted the Sea Alaska Corporation, and they put up, I think, $25,000, and we had about the same amount in our acquisitions fund at the time. And we decided to try to buy this back, and if we succeeded, we would work out some kind of a sharing arrangement to exhibit it. And I arranged to bid over the phone. It was like 3 in the morning when they called me, and it was all in French, and I had my English-French dictionary out, and I was really afraid I was going to say the wrong dollar amount and end up owing them several hundred thousand dollars. anyway, it didn't come to that. Within a minute, the bid was already over at $600,000+ for this one. And it's, again, no documentation. It was just found in a castle in France, but it's clearly Tlingit. And the idea possibly is that it represents, again, a merganser that has the teeth in the beak and the crest of hair on the top of the head. And this is the most recent one that's come up. This was cataloged as an Aleut headdress in a museum in Massachusetts. And they sent me a photo of it, and they said, hey, you know, there's some thought that this might not be an Aleut headdress. Do you have any idea what it is? And I asked to see a picture of the inside of it, which would tell me how thick it was, because nothing but a war helmet would be left that thick. And they sent it to me, and it was clearly another war helmet, you know, not well documented, but that's clearly what it is, and a pretty spectacular one as well. So, finally, this is a historical photo of a Taku chief lying in state. I blacked out his face, but this shows an array of clan crest objects laid out around him, as is the tradition to surround a deceased person or even a dying person with the Et'u to give them strength. And among these, on the right next to the deceased, is what looks like a war helmet, but it always threw me because it didn't have a mouth. It just had kind of a grid work of design across there. It didn't seem to have a mouth anyway. But this is recently surfaced, and I've seen enough photos of it from the side and top to know that that also is a war helmet. But we don't really know anything about it other than this is an elder of the Yanyedi clan of the Taku Tlingit. And so that's another one to add to the list, which you know, that was just a few months ago that we saw these other photos of it. So I think with that, I would like to thank you for coming to the presentation today, and I'd be happy if anyone has questions, feel free to ask them now, or you can save them for later. But again, thank you very much for listening to me.